This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. I am only here hosting this show because of what happened 400 years ago. In August 1619, a ship docked at Point Comfort, Virginia. Its cargo would shape my life and all of what would become America in distinct, precise, and verifiable ways because 400 years ago, the colonies received their first slaves. Their lives shaped mine. From defining the business landscape I would learn to navigate, to setting the cultural speech standards that I would need to master and those I would need to avoid for my journalistic credibility, to the musical tastes that helped me influence the final version of 1A's theme song, to cementing the economic disadvantages that made it harder for me to afford a college education. So in a way, you're listening to the legacy of slavery right now. But I am the very smallest of impacts. A new project in the New York Times Magazine shows an almost dizzying array of lingering effects. It's called the 1619 Project, and it debuted this past weekend. New York Times Magazine correspondent Nicole Hannah-Jones is the mind behind this project, and she joins us from the Times. Nicole, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Nicole, let's begin at the beginning. How did the 1619 Project come about?
In some ways, you could say that the 1619 project is a culmination of, you know, more than 25 years of me thinking about that date. I first came across the year 1619 in a book I was reading in high school, and it was called Before the Mayflower. Now, this book had not been assigned because we didn't really learn about slavery in high school. But my Black Studies teacher, I would ask him to suggest books for me, and he suggested I read that one. And I just remember, I think it was on page 28 or so, seeing that date for the first time in my life and being just shocked, almost like a lightning bolt, that African people had been enslaved here as early as 1619. Just 12 years after the English landed Jamestown and before the Pilgrims even come to Plymouth Rock. Yet we'd never been taught about that date. And I realized that that was intentional. There was a reason why we had not been taught that. And so that date is always stuck in my mind. And as we started to get close to this 400th anniversary year, I just kept thinking that it was going to pass in most American households, and no one was going to even know that there was an anniversary that we should be commemorating, that most Americans have never heard the year 1619. They don't know the origin stories of slavery in this country. And I wanted to try to do something about that. So I pitched this project to the New York Times in January. I pitched it during a meeting that we have to throw around story ideas. And I said that I thought we should dedicate an entire issue of the New York Times Magazine, not to writing a history, but actually to exploring the modern day legacy of that decision made 400 years ago. And that I believed that almost nothing about modern American society has been left untouched by that decision to buy that first group of 20 to 30 Africans and engage in the institution of slavery, and that we could probably show that.
How did you decide what pieces to curate into the project? There are a number of pieces that cover various aspects of American life. How did you figure out what to leave in and what to leave out?
Right. So it's, you know, this is not a comprehensive history. It is just a magazine. There were certain stories that I knew, I believe, needed to be in here. So the story, the piece I did on democracy, I knew I wanted a piece that was going to look at capitalism and its development. I wanted a piece on why we have the weakest social safety net programs of all Western industrialized country. And that piece became a piece on why we don't have universal health care. And I knew I wanted a piece on music. And then outside of that, we had we convened two brainstorming sessions. One was with New York Times staff writers and contributors, and then I called a panel of about 15 historians whose work I really respect and read, and I asked them to come in and brainstorm and help us figure out what were the other stories we should be telling. And the other stories, including Linda Villarosas, who we'll be talking with shortly, came out of that brainstorming, one of those brainstorming sessions.
So it seems like the frame, and it's pretty obvious from, you know, when you scroll through it at the beginning, it seems like the frame of this is that we are thoroughly impacted by the legacy of slavery in every way. But don't we already kind of know that on some level as Americans, that slavery happened at the very beginning of our nation? It's kind of unavoidably impactful. Don't we kind of already know that?
No, I don't think we do at all. I think you can look at the response. I think you can look at how slavery is taught in our textbooks. What we're taught is that slavery was marginal, that it didn't last that long, that it was largely just a product of the South. One of the common things you hear is, well, only 1% of Americans owned slaves, so it couldn't have been that big of a deal. We are certainly not taught that it was central to our foundation. We don't talk enough about what it meant that the first, 10 of our first 12 presidents were enslavers, that the entire Northeast also relied heavily upon the products that were being made by enslaved people, that the banking and shipping industries rose up to support slavery. So we absolutely don't think of slavery as foundational. We think of it as kind of a blip, a mistake that we made, but that doesn't have kind of larger ramifications for everyday American life. And the reaction to this project, I think, is evidence of that.
We asked our listeners what their reactions were. We'll get to some of your calls in a moment, but several of you left notes in our voicemail and on our app, 1A Vox Pop. Here is what Carol had to say.
I'm very sad to say that the only time that I heard about this project was on the 1A Vox Pop. And after I looked up the information and read the New York Times PDF, I was quite impressed with the extensive amount of research that was done and how far back it was that Africans first came to what is now called America. Hopefully this will continue to grow and be shared and talked about in history for years to come.
Carol, thanks very much for sharing your thoughts, and thanks for using our app, 1A Vox Pop, to share those thoughts. Nicole, what have some of the early reactions been like, especially to the incredible depth of the reporting? What kinds of reactions have you been getting so far?
The reaction has been overwhelming. I'm actually astounded by how people have responded to this, the desire to own the physical print copies of this project, the sharing of the project. People have said that, they've learned more in this project than they've learned in their entire lives about slavery, that they had never thought about the institution this way, that even people who read a lot about history didn't know so much of this. And people really reacted powerfully, I think, to two things. One is the framing that this is we are still living the impacts of this legacy, that it is not, as people say, we ended slavery 150 years ago, get over it. I think making those modern connections has been really powerful for people. And I think people have also really responded to the decentering of the kind of white dominant story of our origins and the recentering of Black people as really the perfecters of our democracy and the role that Black Americans have played, particularly for Black folks who have contacted me. That has been so critical to them, where they've told me I can actually finally feel a sense of pride about our history, that we're often taught as Black folks that the fact that our stories begin here with our enslavement is something shameful to us, that means that we are kind of lesser and that we are not really full citizens of this country. And,
right.
And so many Black people who have responded said that this has changed the way that they feel about themselves as Americans. And that I think that's probably the response that has meant the most to me.
I do want to talk to you more about that idea of Blacks as the perfecters of our democracy. I'll get to that in a minute, but let's squeeze in one quick call before we have to pause. In Tennessee, Mimi is on the line. Hey, Mimi, what did you think of the 1619 Project?
Hi. I think it's breaking wonderful new ground. We're looking at things in terms of ancient history, that everything that we consider a wonder of the world, from the pyramids to the Parthenon, to the Taj Mahal, were all built by slave labor. And nowhere in the history books do you hear anything about the labor that it was required to build those things. And here with the 1619 Project, you're doing something new in history, I think, and that is calling attention to the people that actually built it.
Is that kind of the biggest piece for you, Mimi, that stood out to you in the 1619 Project, or were there others?
I think that's putting the whole thing in perspective, that throughout the world, slavery has always been a part of what makes things that you couldn't build otherwise. You couldn't ask free people to do that kind of labor. So slavery has been here and is with us still everywhere. But the fact that here in the United States, this project is calling attention to the fact that these people were here from the beginning and are still here, and now we're giving them credence. I think that's a big difference.
Yeah, Mimi, I really appreciate you calling in to share your thoughts. Thanks very much. We'll get to some more of your thoughts and calls and questions and criticisms of the 1619 Project in just a moment. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Home Instead Senior Care. Gerontologist and caregiver advocate Lakeland Hogan reflects on Home Instead's mission to enhance the lives of aging adults and their families.
You don't stop living once you hit a certain age. You can still live a rich, meaningful life through your later years. And so we are really excited to be celebrating our 25th anniversary at Home Instead and to be still working towards our mission.
To learn more about Home Instead Senior Care, go to homeinstead.com.
Hey, you know what next year is, right? 2020, election year. The news is only going to get crazier. So join me, Sam Sanders, for a wrap-up of the week's news and culture that will not make you want to pull your hair out. Download and listen every weekend to It's Been a Minute from NPR.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing the New York Times 1619 Project with Nicole Hannah-Jones. Before we bring in a few more voices, let me get to some of your comments. Sarah tweeted, "I am the direct descendant of slave owners going back to the 1600s. I have documents and names. It is my duty to speak that I am middle class because of that enslavement. I teach my son, nieces, and nephews that this horror is why we are privileged." Before we add one more voice, Nicole, you said that African Americans have been the perfecters of our democracy, and you write about this in your piece in the 1619 Project. What do you mean by that, the perfecters of our democracy?
What I mean is that at our founding, we were not a democracy. The Constitution is actually a decidedly anti-democratic document before we start to amend it. So it denies the vote to the majority of Americans. It denies the vote to women, to Black people, to Native people, and really at the time also to white people who didn't own property. But Black people took those words literally. And they weren't just lofty ideals. Black Americans were determined to make those ideals real because, of course, they could not receive any of the rights that were laid out in the Constitution at the time and wouldn't get those rights for another 100 years. So if you look at the role that Black people have played from the first rebellion of enslaved people in the 1700s all the way until now, it has been to protest and to resist and to try to get this country to actually live up both in law and policy and culturally to the ideals laid out in our founding documents. And while America has fought many wars abroad ostensibly to maintain and bring democracy to other peoples outside of our borders, Black Americans have fought in those wars and then had to come back home and wage a sustained war against their own fellow countrymen in order to receive those rights. And if you look at what has resulted from the Black struggle for democracy has been the democratization of our entire society. You look at gay rights movement, women rights movement, at disability rights, at immigration rights. They all owe a big part of that ability to move forward to the Black freedom struggle. And every civil rights law that came out of Black freedom struggles did not just bring about rights to Black Americans, but to all marginalized people.
Let's add another voice to our conversation from the New York Times. Linda Villarosa is a contributing writer for the Times Magazine and also the director of the journalism program at the City College of New York. Linda, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Now, your essay in the project talks about the lasting impact of slavery on medicine. Give us an example of one of those impacts that you think many of us might never have known about or considered.
So one of them is the idea that began in during the years of slavery that black people had extremely high pain tolerance. So that was used to justify medical experiments, mainly by Southern doctors and scientists, but also to justify continued slavery because you could work people to almost death or sometimes to death. And then that idea that began then has endured. So there was a study in 2016, so that's only 3 years ago, of medical residents and medical students that found that they still believed many of those myths. So they believed that black people had less pain sensitivity when something happened like getting your hand slammed in a car door or breaking a bone. So that means that prescription medication for pain and also drives people away is, you know, incorrect, and also drives people away from the medical system if you feel like you're going to hurt. And the other thing that endured was the idea that the black skin is thicker than white skin. And so that, again, is a reason to say, oh, black people don't feel the same amount of pain. So in 2016, medical residents and medical students still believe that myth.
I should note that we've gotten a number of comments from folks about this kind of rethinking, reshaping of our conception of the country, which the 1619 Project is very clear that it's designed to reframe this. But a number of the comments reflect the one that we got from Charlie, who wrote on our Facebook page, "It sounds ridiculous to negate any history that happened before that point, much like it seems silly to ignore the actual date of the founding of the country. Why do Democrats hate the United States so much and spend so much time trying to drag our country through the mud?" Nicole? And
sorry.
I can hear that Wesley's in the room now. Hi, that's Wesley Morris, who is a critic at large at the New York Times. Wesley, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So since you were the first voice that I heard bust out laughing, why don't you respond to Charlie?
Well, I mean, I think that most of us in general don't have what we have or not have what we don't have without acknowledging what all has gone on in the last 400 years. I don't know why this has to be a partisan issue. Everybody had a hand in slavery, and everybody has a hand in not talking about the hand they had in slavery. This seems like a perfectly nonpartisan history, and resolving it is going to be like going to require some bipartisan self-awareness.
Yeah, let's be clear. This is not an advertisement for the Democratic Party, and
at all.
Anyone who knows my work knows I am critical of all parties that want to deny full and equal access to rights to black Americans. But to get to the actual meat of what he was saying, my opening essay clearly talks about the founding in 1776. It does not argue, it cannot argue that that is not important and critical because we are not even the United States without 1776. What it's arguing is that if we think about what is foundational to the development of America, our political systems, our ideas, our culture, then 1619 is just as important as 1776, and that we cannot pick and choose which parts of our history we think matter and which ones don't. We can't pick the parts of our history that we think only give our country glory, but then have to deal with why are there 40 million black people in this country right now? And there's 40 million black people in this country right now because at the time of the Declaration, Thomas Jefferson owned 130 people, and also one-fifth of the population would get none of the rights in the Constitution. So the real question is, if this is not a history we should be ashamed of, why do people want to spend so much time denying what are just the facts of who we are? My opening essay is the most patriotic thing I've ever written. My opening essay is saying that black Americans believe fundamentally in the idea of this country and die to make it true. Well, that's the story of the revolution, right? So I think we have to really ask, why do people have this visceral reaction to centering black people, to telling the truth about who we are, and how do we move past something that we can't even deal with?
We'll get to more of that visceral reaction in just a minute. Before we pause, though, Wesley, I just want to contextualize your place in this conversation, because your essay uses music as a way to examine America's relationship with black culture and the legacy of slavery. Why focus on music?
I think it is the thing that is the oldest entertainment form that involves both races, and it's the thing that most immediately enslaved people brought with them from Africa. And it was also the thing that white people, in seeing black people perform or communicate with each other through song, were most captivated by and wanted to take to other white people. And, you know, there's a whole the essay that I write is basically explaining how we wind up getting some of the complexes that we have about black entertainment, but also how we have this great moving tradition of black entertainment that comes right out of American slavery.
I want to talk more about that as we continue with New York Times critic at large Wesley Morris, contributing writer Linda Villarosa, and Nicole Hannah-Jones, investigative reporter who led this project. We want to get to some more of the critiques of the 1619 Project and also how people can remain involved in it. You've been working on some materials for students as well to be able to talk about this at an age-appropriate level. We'll discuss that and take more of your calls in just a minute. Stay close.
Support for NPR and the following message come from CarMax. For more than 25 years, CarMax has made it easy to sell your car. They provide free appraisals and offers on the spot. CarMax will buy your car even if you don't buy theirs. In fact, CarMax has bought more than 8 million vehicles. To learn more and schedule your free appraisal, visit CarMax.com.
Hey there, it's Joshua. Thanks for listening to the 1A podcast. Please take a moment to subscribe and leave us a rating. That helps other people find the show. And don't forget, you can catch the news roundup at the end of every week.
While you were sleeping, a whole bunch of news was happening around the world. And up first is the NPR News podcast that gets you caught up on the big news in a small amount of time. Spend about 10 minutes with Up First, weekday mornings from NPR News.
Back now to our conversation with Linda Villarosa, Wesley Morris, and Nicole Hannah-Jones of the New York Times about the 1619 Project. We'll get to some more of your calls and comments in just a minute. But Wesley, with your essay regarding music, you write, "Loving black culture has never meant loving black people, too." What did you mean by that?
I mean, it's just easier to take this entertainment that we, this idea that black people are here to delight and entertain, well, everybody, and not have to think about the people doing the entertaining. It's easy to love black music because it sounds great. And to want to try to perform it yourself if you are not black. But that affiliation with black music doesn't also necessitate, at least to my eye, historically, any responsibility to make or improve the lives of black people, to acknowledge the history from which a lot of the music that other non-black performers wind up doing. So there's just this disconnect between the people and the sound of the people. It's very easy. It's been historically very easy to just separate those things or to use black people to denigrate themselves and relegate them to this place where all they can be in the eyes of, for our purposes, white America is entertainers.
I think the one fact in your story that kind of stunned me the most had to do with the origins of the term Jim Crow, which was performed by a minstrel performer named Thomas Dartmouth Rice. Here's the clip of that song that made the term famous.
Wheel about and turn about and do just so. Every time I wheel about, I jump Jim Crow.
That's where the term comes from. Wesley, can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, the story is basically that it feels in part like a myth, but it's a myth that, you know, is substantiated by a lot of historical documentation. It's just that it's such a convenient story that this white man happens upon this old black man cleaning a horse. And the tune that he's singing is somewhat similar to the one that we just heard. And he's inspired by this man's body movements. The man is crippled. We can only imagine what his palsied hands and disfigured body would have resulted from. But he sees this man and has like no ostensible sympathy for the man himself. He just hears this tune and sees these movements and is inspired to go out and perform the tune and the movements in blackface. And we don't know the man's name, the old black man cleaning the horse. We don't know his name. But Thomas Dartmouth Rice, T.D. Rice, has given him one. And it's Jim Crow. And, you know, the performance of that song that night at that theater was an electrifying event. And it was the foundation of American popular culture in that, you know, there are stories of people leaving that theater and just singing the song for weeks. Little boys, working men. It was the number one song in America, so to speak, for years.
Before we get back to comments, I do want to make the point, though, Wesley, part of what your article does is to try to bust down some of these notions about the dividing lines in music. I mean, we've had this kind of conversation on our program before, but part of what I took from your essay was not just the role of slavery in defining our popular culture, but the role of our popular culture in trying to redefine the racial lines of our music and kind of ignore the fact that we are much more of a gumbo culturally, musically, than we sometimes like to admit.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the one thing about art that's great, I mean, not the one thing about art that's great, but one of the many things about art that's great is that there can be a kind of optimism in the creative process because the creative process is inherently non-destructive. And so the idea that you would have some of our great music, whether it's sung by a black person or a white person, was created by many different people. And also the idea that at some point there became a moment in the American culture where we began to produce, write, compose, play, distribute our own music. And the definition of a particular American sound that comes from black people, but is in many ways not terribly different from the stories that white people were telling about themselves in their love songs, but coming from an entirely black production company in Motown specifically, it just argues against all the things that a force like minstrelsy would argue about black people, that we were stupid, that we couldn't create, you know, the thing that black people most wanted to do was remain enslaved. It was a huge project of minstrelsy too, and so in something like Motown, you just have a force that you have a cultural force that argues against all of those things without ever having to say, you know, minstrelsy's bad or we are smart. Like, just look at us, hear us. There's no argument against the fact that, you know, we can make our own sound and it doesn't have to come through white people. But obviously one of the great things about American popular music is that, you know, it does bring all kinds of people together to both make and enjoy it.
Let's keep going with as many of your calls and comments as we can in the time we have left. Let's go to Durham, North Carolina, where Molly is standing by. Hey, Molly, I know our time is tight, but what did you think of the 1619 Project?
I haven't had a chance to read the articles yet. I've ordered 14 copies for myself and my family. As a white person, I've considered myself educated and have tried to research as much as I could. I've read enslaved narratives. I've read all the books that came out of the Harlem Renaissance, and mainly because even as a child, I could not understand where the woman who came to help my mother wax the floors went, because I never saw her except when she came to our house. And she never sat down to eat with us, even though my mother would ask her to. And I've always been fascinated by why black people have not been included in all of our narratives. It's, as a white person, I'm ashamed of that. And as 73, I've been trying to work all of my life to include, be inclusive and accepting and caring. So I'm excited about getting the articles and sharing them with people that I love.
Well, Molly, I'm glad
and I appreciate having this.
Well, and we appreciate having you share your thoughts as well. As the grandson of someone who was one of those domestics, I appreciate your empathy for them, especially in retrospect. There are a few more aspects of this that we got to get to before our time is up. Worth noting that this series has gotten some very strong pushback, including from a number of conservative commentators. Newt Gingrich offered his thoughts earlier on Fox and Friends. Here's what he had to say about the 1619 Project.
Yeah, the whole project is a lie. Look, I think slavery is a terrible thing. I think putting slavery in context is important. We still have slavery in places around the world today, so we need to recognize this is an ongoing story. I think certainly if you're an African American, slavery is at the center of what you see as the American experience. But for most Americans, most of the time, there were a lot of other things going on. There were several hundred thousand white Americans who died in the Civil War in order to free the slaves. The fact is, I saw one reference that the New York Times claims that the American Revolution was caused in part to defend slavery. That is such historically, factually false nonsense that it's embarrassing that the New York Times is doing this.
That's Newt Gingrich speaking this week on Fox and Friends. Nicole, I'd like your reaction to that briefly. There's something else I'd like to ask you. We should note that at least part of what Mr. Gingrich said is just purely factually incorrect. Hundreds of thousands of whites did not just die in the Civil War to free the slaves. Hundreds of thousands died to keep them, and hundreds of thousands more died to keep the economic system that advantaged them. So that's false. That's just false on its face. But beyond that, Nicole, your reactions to what he said?
I mean, I'm not going to spend a lot of time addressing Newt Gingrich at all. He can't really push back on the facts. No one can argue that we were actually founded as a slaveocracy, which means a nation run by slave owners. The history on this is very clear. I don't really care if Newt Gingrich doesn't like the reframing that we're doing. The facts are what they are. We don't fight a revolution where we have the chance at the Declaration and at the Constitution to abolish slavery if we had been opposed to slavery. You don't have the majority of the founding fathers being enslavers, many of them from Virginia, and continuing to own enslaved people until they died, codifying it in the Constitution, ensuring that it would last at least until 1808, and then continuing it until 1865, where, by the way, we're the third to the last country in the Americas to abolish slavery, only the second country that abolishes it through war, the first being Haiti, where enslaved people rose up against their masters,
right,
and then pretend somehow that we are the ones who are getting the history wrong, that slavery is foundational.
It's also worth making the point that in your article, it notes that the British were moving towards abolishing slavery. The call for that was growing in 1776. And it also kind of raises the question of how could these little colonies have the wealth to fight the world's biggest navy and a global superpower, but for the economic buttressing of slavery. Before
right,
we go.
I'm sorry, I know
yes.
We need to move on,
yeah.
But I also need to address the hundreds of thousands of white people died to end slavery.
Hundreds
of thousands of white people joined the Union to defend the Union, and most of them didn't care about whether they ended slavery or not, including Abraham Lincoln, who said if he could have saved the Union by keeping slavery, he would have, and if he could have saved the Union by ending slavery, he would have, and he ended slavery as a political maneuver. So we need to get rid of that myth, and also there were thousands and thousands of black people who fought in the Union for their own liberation and died for a country that wouldn't even give them freedom.
Before we let you go, Nicole, could you speak to the educational resources that are available? You partnered with the Pulitzer Center to develop a curriculum for students. In our last few seconds, could you tell us about that and where people can find it?
Gladly, because hopefully if people get this part, we won't have to be having these conversations again in 20 years. So we have partnered with the Pulitzer Center to create a free curriculum on the 1619 Project. Educators can go, they can download the project, they can download study guides and teaching prompts and curriculum. They just have to go to the Pulitzer Center's website. And what we're hoping, again, as I just said, is that if our children are taught this history correctly in the first place, then maybe 20 years from now, we don't have to reteach them as adults.
Right. I believe their site is PulitzerCenter.org. PULITZER. Pulitzer Center. That's Nicole Hannah-Jones, Linda Villarosa, and Wesley Morris of the New York Times. Nicole, Linda, Wesley, thank you all very much for talking to us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
This conversation was produced by Haley Blassingame and edited by Miranda Fulmore. To learn more about our team, visit the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.